Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is another two-hour session of Zero Point Radio, brought to you by BBS Radio. My background is as a clinical and forensic psychologist, and I've studied mystical, spiritual, and occult ideas now for over 30 years. I'm also interested in modern physics and ancient metaphysics and comparative studies of physics and ancient metaphysics. In the Zero Point Radio show, we explore not only the issues of human consciousness and mystical psychology, but we also explore widely discussing the current world situation and current events. And again, we'll bring you a kind of wide diversity of topics and discussion. We're going to open the phone lines up in about a half hour. I'll introduce now my co-host, James Moffat. Jim, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Good.
Good.
So we're back on again. Once more, 2 hours.
Yeah.
We've got almost 3 years of shows up there now, the same day. It's quite a body of material.
It was funny when you mentioned that. I was thinking that it was only 2 years, and I realized, boy, 3 years, that went fast, eh?
And yeah.
We covered, there's a certain degree of repetition. As you say, the position that you're outlining is difficult to understand. You can't sort of incorporate it all in one two-hour session, and people can't sort of grasp the significance of it all. It takes a long time, so there's a certain degree of repeating of certain material, but at the same time, I say it would be interesting to go through it all. I mean, we've talked about a lot of different things over the last 3 years, and at times it's better than other times, but there's certainly a lot of, I think, very interesting material in our shows, and if people are interested, they should access the archives on BBS Radio, which are very, very rich archive of material there. It's really quite extraordinary what you can gain access to. So,
yeah, we're really presenting a really quite alternate model of the nature of existence. That's essentially what it is. It's an alternative model of the structure of existence. Because in a way, the whole last century of modern psychology and science dismissed the idea that human beings had a soul or a spiritual nature and assumed people are only material biological organisms that live and die with the body. And that's kind of been the dogma that's been propagated through the last century, through all the educational system and within our broader society. And then what we're proposing is that we need to come back to this psychology of the soul and to draw from the esoteric, mystical, and spiritual teachings of humankind, because we explore widely across mystical Christianity, Judaism, Sufism, Vedic studies, and other sources. We try to bring these together and show the kind of model of higher dimensional existence that are embodied in these spiritual psychologies. That we are not simply the material body, but that there is some higher dimensional process by which the body is, that the spiritual soul is somehow embodied into the material body, but we are not simply the body, and that there is some I within the human being that exists beyond physical death. And then what we're doing is the two distinctive aspects of my teaching and our work as we present it. One is the heart doctrine. The idea that the essential nature of self has to do with the heart, and that true I is known within the heart through the awakening of the heart center, and that ordinarily people are not properly centered in their essential heart nature, but instead the mind becomes dominant, the mind centered in the head, and it forms what Gurdjieff calls a false consciousness system. And this is all the ideas we've been indoctrinated into and conditioned into, and all the things we've been led to believe or have been deceived about, all the ideas we develop in our mind about, and that all forms what Gurdjieff calls a false consciousness system. And he says our true consciousness has passed into the subconscious, which is related to the heart and the higher emotional center. And instead we have this false consciousness system established within the mind, particularly what he calls the formatory apparatus. The formatory apparatus is that part of the mind that works like a tape recorder. So it simply tape records information that's fed into it and repeats that information and knowledge as its own. So hence we see the role of the media in modern times in creating a completely false consciousness system. Not only the media, but the whole educational system has created a completely false consciousness system. So people have led to believe, rah, 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 United States is a democracy. So people have been led to believe that they live in a democratic country and that they have viable options between different candidates and that anybody could become president. And they have this big illusion of American democracy. Whereas the whole time, the whole thing's been a complete deceit. We have three presidential candidates, all belong to the Trilateral Commission and the CFR, and they all embody the same vested corporate elite interests, and they're all tied into bringing about the New World Order. Meanwhile, people are completely deceived about this, have no idea of this, and so we have this whole false consciousness system. We have the idea that America protects the world and that America goes around the world and has bases in 150 countries around the world and 750 military bases all around the world, and America is a great protector of the world. But then if we really look at human history, we see America's not been such a grand championer of democracy. Instead, they've undermined democracies around the world. They've set up dictators and tyrants. They've tortured people. They've carried out assassinations around the world. We begin to see, oh, no, the CIA and the United States government has come to represent the interests of these mad people who are behind the scenes are trying to bring about a new world order. It's all been a lie. And in a way, all the people have been led along like little sheep. They're being led along like little sheep to slaughter. They haven't seen what's been building and developing within American society. I think we're at a stage just similar to prior to World War II. And because after World War II, all the German people said, oh, we didn't know anyone was being murdered in concentration camps or these awful things were being done. We didn't know that. Nobody knew it. And similarly in America today, you have, 600 concentration camps built around the country. They all have, not all, but many of them have railway trains and yards ready to transport prisoners in, and you have trains with shackles in, and the stage is all getting set for another Holocaust, this time against the American people. And not just, evil Islamic fascio terrorist Bin Laden with his reindeer. Not them. I mean, this is against the American people. This is the American people who, that is what is intended. And this whole agenda of the New World Order and imposition of a fascist police state, electronic surveillance everywhere, implants. Meanwhile, you're being poisoned through the air, through the chemtrails. You're being poisoned through your inoculations and for flu and Gardasil, and you're being poisoned through your food and genetically modified foods that are causing cancer. All these things are being done, and the momentum of the whole system is so great. It's like people stand helpless while the whole thing proceeds, and then everybody is powerless to stop it. There's hope too in this time of absolute madness. We're on a time where Bush or the Israelis can commit another terrorist event and another mass murder, this time of Iranians, and start a new war against the Iranians and murder, we don't know how many, hundreds of thousands or millions of people, to protect America from, or Israel from Iranian nuclear weapons. The whole thing is such a farce. So we're going to use nuclear weapons on them in because of the prospect that they might get them. The whole thing is so insane. The whole thing is an Orwellian nightmare of Ministry of Double Talk, where the Ministry of Defense isn't the Ministry of Defense. It's the Ministry of Aggression and Acquisition and Imperialism. It's funny, you think back to Nazi Germany, how Hitler wanted to rule the world. Well, that's the project for a new American century. It's for America to rule the world and subjugate people of all the countries of the world and get all the resources of the world for the elites. And these elites want to reduce the world population from 6 billion or so to approximately 500 million. They are actually carrying out these processes of genocide intentionally. And they even write about it in the Club of Rome and all the Rockefeller round tables and the institutes. They all have their program of eugenics. Eugenics. And all this brings me to a quote from Gurdjieff in Beelzebub's Tales to His War. Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, sorry. And he's discussing with his grandson, Hussein, about the causes of war. And one of the things that Gurdjieff says that always struck me as very peculiar, he said, he's talking to his grandson, Hussein, and Hussein wants to know, how could these human beings engage in these terrible processes of reciprocal destruction, which is what Gurdjieff calls war, the processes of reciprocal destruction. So Beelzebub explains in this book, he says, how is it possible that these people's essence is gradually brought to such a phenomenal being ableness to destroy, for no rhyme or reason, the existence of other beings similar to themselves? Like, what could happen in the essence of these people who are fine to destroy for no rhyme or reason the existence of other beings, of other human beings? And he concludes that this, quote, terrifying periodic being need to destroy each other's existence had been acquired over centuries due to the abnormal conditions of existence established there by past generations, as well as due to cowardice and fear. Beelzebub says, quote, he begins from a natural feeling of self-preservation to strive with all his being to destroy as many as possible of the existences of the beings of the enemy side in order to have the greater chance of surviving his own existence, of saving his own existence. So it's a very peculiar idea, really, that we try to kill off the other person because in order to save our own existence. And this is like the psychology of the elite. It's like they have this notion that they're these elites' preferred human beings and that the Earth isn't going to be able to sustain 6 billion people and we're going to destroy the planet through carbon exhaust and carbon use. And so we have to reduce the world's population in order to survive. And so really behind the whole thing is this kind of cowardice and fear of wanting to destroy off other people in order to somehow save their own life or save their privileged position. And we actually have this playing out on an international level in the world, the events of our day. It is clearly a madness, a period of madness in the life of humankind. If America attacks Iran or Israel attacks Iran, this could easily escalate into broader Mid-Eastern conflict. And then Russia and China themselves are tied into Iran and surely see the fascist agenda of the Americans. to abound, we don't know how other powers might be drawn into such a conflict. So we really are at a very critical period in the life of humankind. And at the same time, there's more and more people coming forward and saying the truth of 9/11. 9/11 was an inside job. How could we ever have thought otherwise? It's funny because I thought otherwise for 5 years. I saw it all unfold on TV, and I just kind of didn't question it. And the media comes in and provides you with all the answers, and it's all scripted, and it's all planned ahead of time. Even the fake videos of what happened is all planned ahead of time. We create a completely false consciousness system, and then the 90% of Americans all wave the little flags made in China and say, yeah, we got to invade Afghanistan to protect us against Osama bin Laden and his reindeers. They're being given shelter in Afghanistan, so we'll invade Afghanistan and get their oil and drugs, but we won't mention that. Instead, we'll just have a military base there and subjugate the people there, and we're doing it to save America and spread democracy, and because we protect the rights of women and children and other human beings and the environment. So we'll invade Afghanistan, then we'll invade Iraq, and now we want to go for Iran, and Syria's on the block too. Now, if we look back in World War history, we see, wow, that's kind of similar to what Mr. Adolf Hitler did. The same thing, invading other countries, staging state-sponsored terrorist acts to use the media to create propaganda and galvanize the German population behind the Nazi program. And this same thing is all done in America. You can turn on CNN and Fox News and see all these people. They're complete frauds. They're complete frauds. Everything they say is a lie. They've been so instrumental in creating this completely false consciousness system. So Americans have become the terrorists. Well, actually, it's not Americans, of course, but what seems to be the American government. See, it's not really the American government. It doesn't represent the American people, and the American people are a good-hearted people. But they've allowed certain criminal psychopathic elements and tied into the corporate elites, psychopaths and perverts, to take over the control of their country. When I was in New Zealand, John Eisen, a Jewish man from New York City who's lived in New Zealand, has a wonderful magazine called Uncensored. He has a website at www.uncensored.co.newzealand, an expose magazine. And he had a perfect term for the nature of America. He called it a psychopathocracy. We thought we had a democracy, and then we realized we have a psychopathocracy. We have a group of psychopaths who have taken over the government, who've infiltrated the CIA and the FBI and all these intelligence agencies and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and we have a group of psychopaths and perverts who have taken over America. And they're destroying America systematically, the wealth of America, getting rid of the middle class, any feasible jobs. They're destroying the healthcare system. They use all these poisons of all these big pharma companies that are putting poisons in their inoculations, and they put out all these drugs that they manufacture out of petroleum products, and people all consume them. They show it on TV. I saw it, it's funny, last week in Canada, our great Prime Minister of Canada spent $300 million of Canadian money to give Gardasil vaccinations to all the young women of Eastern Canada. Isn't that nice? Stephen Harper, boy, what is your agenda? And then I saw a thing on CBC television, two doctors they had on saying how men could also get the Gardasil vaccination. And they showed two men going, one doctor saying that he thought it could be useful to his men so that they didn't have problems with sexually transmitted diseases. And you had some men trotting in and getting their inoculations of Gardasil. You see, and all the little sheep see that on TV and say, oh, we better get our Gardasil vaccinations. The whole thing is so insane. It's so insane. It's so insane that people could ever think that the first tower in New York City where the fires were almost out, and there was a man standing at the opening of the building hoping to be rescued, and the firemen were almost about to put out the fire in the South Tower. They almost put the fire out. They would have likely discovered there wasn't an airplane there, so they couldn't allow that, so they had to blow South Tower up before they could blow North Tower up. But fortunately, of course, the radios didn't work too well that day, so it would have prevented them from relaying the information. Hey, there's no airplane here. Where's Osama bin Laden? We didn't find him. The whole thing is so insane. Do people have no belief in the laws of physics? You think an airplane crashes into the Pentagon and creates a 12, 14-foot wide hole, and people believe it? And there are 1,000 security cameras, and the government won't release any of them to prove their case? Like, what don't people understand? Like, criminals cover up. They do a con, and the American population got conned. You got conned by the neocons. They had a new con for you. You got conned. You believed it. It's like believing in the existence of Santa Claus. You see, so many, I saw Santa Claus on TV. I saw him. CNN reported his progress on Christmas Eve flying from the North Pole. I've seen Santa Claus. I believe in Santa Claus. Yeah. Just similarly, everybody, I believe in Osama bin Laden and his pictures put up everywhere, and the Islamic Israel, the fascists are everywhere. They're everywhere. They create this big boogeyman, this fear of terrorists. More and more money into all the coffers of all the corporations in the security business and the militarization of the whole society to fight the terrorists. And the whole time, the terrorists are the ones who are terrorizing the American population. It's not Osama bin Laden and the Islamic fascists. It's American fascists and the elites, the corporate elites who are carrying through forward on their schemes for genocide against the human race, trying to empower people, bring about police states. The Constitution of the United States is no more. It exists on paper, much to the displeasure of George Bush, but it does still exist on paper, even though he can declare an emergency anytime, and you have no constitutional rights, and people have picked up all the time, no trials, no lawyers, the tortured not only in Guantanamo Bay, but around the world in other facilities. And then we come to believe it, and it's all played up on TV, why we need to torture to protect ourselves. The degradation of human values in American society is terrible. Not only American society, but now we realize in Canada, oh, our government's part of it too. They've hidden the truth of 9/11. Why would they hide the truth of 9/11 from the Canadian public? Because the same people who did 9/11 control the Canadian government. That's why. This week in Canada, we're getting the Harper government is passing the same laws about copyright violations, so they're going to be able to seize anybody's computer, and you're not going to be able to travel with your computer, supposedly for copyright reasons. Gives them complete control of your computers and their access to it. And this bill isn't even going to go through the House of Parliament, because Harper's decided it doesn't need to. It can just be dealt with in committee. You see, there's such a corrosion of all the values, you know, the Bill of Rights in Canada, the Constitution of the United States. These things mean nothing to these people. And meanwhile, there's an awakening happening around the world. People are beginning to realize, wow, 9/11 was an inside job. Governor former Ventura from the United States, he admits 9/11 was an inside job. I just saw a thing on the internet last night, 25 military officers who signed a petition a couple of years ago claiming that obviously there was something more involved in it. You know, it's brought up in Italian parliament, in Pakistani parliament, in Japanese parliament. Like, people around the world are beginning to realize we've been conned. There are a group of neocons, and they serve this fascist underlying elite element who have absolutely taken over American society as well as elsewhere. We have the same problems in Canada and Mexico, Europe. It's kind of like in around the world that the psychopaths and the criminal elites almost unanimously rise to the top. It's terrible. The scum rises to the top. That's the only way of describing it. And that's what's happened. While we were sleeping, the scum rose to the top. And now it's like, oh no, the karma of the American people may be coming down on the American people. If we don't turn these trends around, American society, as well as people in many other nations, we're in severe problems. We're facing really what may make the Holocaust of World War II look like kindergarten. They didn't get it right that time. Their plans now are much, much broader, and they're so in place. The only chance is the awakening of humankind. To awaken and realize what's been happening, and for people to turn around. And for those of us who wake up, then we have to have courage in order to face this insanity of our times. And the word courage actually means having a new heart. Courage is a new heart in French. La cour. Age means new heart. So we have to have courage to try to face this madness in our time and hopefully wake up before the next step of the genocidal plan and the bombing of Iran and the spreading of further war. And they use the bombs over there. And do you think radioactive materials respect the national boundaries? Do you think the radioactive dust clouds, they just go up and say, oh, we can't go past Iran, we're gonna stop here? No, we're gonna irradiate the people of China and the whole Middle East. You know? After the war in Iraq, the higher depleted uranium levels were measured in Texas, now through southern states. All of this stuff, we're part of a world community, and yet it's like these people care nothing for desecrating the land, the air, the water. We're facing a crazy, crazy time, and I believe that between now 2008, and I think we're at a very precarious time now, and between now and 2012, it's going to turn one way or the other. We're going to end up with a fascist America, and we're going to have millions of Americans being slaughtered in concentration camps. The people in the truth movement and resistance movements and peace movements and so on and so forth, or else it's going to be turned around. And people are going to wake up to the criminality of what's been done. And if justice could ever be brought to bear on earth as it is above, well then the people who would be in those concentration camps would be someone quite different than who expected. It would be those people who have been building them. And then we would have worldwide truth hearings about 9/11, about the gangster banksters and the corporate elites and the illegal, all these truths would come out. Boy, imagine how interesting TV would be then. Hey, turn on TV, can you imagine that? And really get truth on TV instead of propaganda intentionally designed to deceive you and dummy you down? Hey, imagine turning on the TV and having truth news. Like, it would be so amazing. Everyone would be glued to their TV. Imagine what a boost it would be to reporters and people who, you know, they used to be what they called investigative reporters, who would actually investigate things and report about them. And that's almost completely lacking in the mainstream media now. So that many reporters would be freed up again to tell the truth. Completely change the whole media system. The media has been so complicit in creating this whole nightmare. See, in Canada, they have laws. Anyone, any organization or company or individual who has been involved in terrorist activities, the country has the right to seize the assets of those individuals. So imagine if the people of the United States actually could bring to court these people who have done these atrocious things in American society and bring them all to, into courts and uncover the fabric of the webs of deceit that they've woven and expose who these people are, it would bring about a new America. You could, all the assets of all these people, all the assets of all the media have been complicit in this, all the media assets should be reclaimed by the people of the United States of America. Similarly in Canada, and similarly around the world. Because there have been, these elites have done these criminal things around the world. And the more people around the world realize, oh, well, these corporations are completely criminal terrorist organizations. So all their assets can be seized and returned to the people of our nations. It would pay off all the debts of all nations on earth. Because this 1% of the population has accumulated 50% of the wealth of the nations. So all the poverty of all the nations, it's all owed to these criminal elites. So all we have to do is wake up and realize more and more of the structure of the whole thing that has happened. And if justice could ever be brought about in the world, we would have these people in those camps. We certainly wouldn't use torture on them. We'd treat them fairly, and they can, could serve time until they want to come forward and speak the truth, and then people might have forgiveness, as was done in South America at one point when the apartheid system came down. They had truth hearings, and certain people, in a way, were, once they came forward and spoke the truth and it unraveled more and more, then they were, they could be pardoned. Many people in America have not wanted to become part of what they became involved in, and they didn't realize where it was going and what all it was. Hopefully people can turn around. We have, the people now are trying to stop this imminent bombing of Iran. It's been reported in several newspapers around the world this week. There have been leaks saying that this is on the table, and people expect it to be on the table before the end of George Bush's reign of terror. See, we have to wake up and realize that we've been completely deceived as to who the terrorists were. The media are the media of the terrorists, the mainstream media. They have become an intentional propaganda machine, spreading hatred, justifying wars, deceiving the public. They're all complicit in it. These people should all be having the Nuremberg rites read out to them. Their names are on lists. We can put these people's names on lists, like who's behind all these things. Just look at who attend their meeting, the Security and Prosperity Partnership. There we have 30 corporate executives all conspiring in private, conspiring, breathing together, planning their next levels of their schemes, how to get it through without people being aware of it. The whole thing is a lie. The whole thing is a criminal network. We're in a very, very sad state in our society. And all the fine words on TV and all the fine words of the American Constitution and Canadian Bill of Rights, these mean nothing to these people. These people don't even have basic human values. See, most people in life, like, if someone offered me, you know, $50,000 to murder someone, most people in life wouldn't do that, because in a way that there's something in a lot of human beings, that a feeling of justice or appreciation of the value of life or the beauty of life or the sacredness of human life, that you wouldn't murder people simply to make money and acquire power and position. What's happened in America is the lowest types, people ruled by money, sex, and power, came to take over American and Canadian and European society. This has been the case through centuries. It's not really simply a new phenomena. I think what's new is the fact that there are now millions of people waking up and seeing the underlying patterns and having a new level of understanding of history. See, in the last months and years, the truth has come out about John F. Kennedy's assassination. It was involved the CIA. E. Howard Hunt, CIA agent, admitted to it on his deathbed. Now the evidence is all coming out, Robert Kennedy's assassination. There was a CIA involvement again. That's a whole another false flag terrorist event blamed on Sirhan Sirhan, who always could never remember what had happened and couldn't possibly have been the shooter of Robert Kennedy. That's all come out now. It's coming into court again. Martin Luther King, another MK Ultra type situation and involving the CIA and agencies again. All of these assassinations, all of these things, and the media all the way along hides the truth from everybody. And then the commission set up to investigate these things, and then you see, realize these commissions are just staffed by their accomplices who are complicit in the cover-up. Because then you begin to see all the inconsistencies and ridiculous, like the 9/11 commission report. They don't even mention building for another 47-story building fell down. They don't, you know, the whole thing is a fraud. What can't people see? You see, there's all the evidences from the events that occurred on 9/11. No person with any intelligence can study that literature that's emerged on that and conclude that what we were told was true. The story of Osama bin Laden and his reindeers bringing down those fine towers. That's just nothing near like what happened. But now there's just such an accumulation of evidences from all different areas that we have very, very serious problem in our countries. What we thought were democracies have become psychopathocracies, and we are ruled by psychopaths. And this is already in place. It's in place now. It's in place now. So it's not simply something that's going to be done. They're going to do more things, but it's in place now. They have effective control of our nations now. So there is a revolution on the Ron Paul revolution. This most astonishing man who could lead America into a new century with keen insights into the whole Federal Reserve, so many of the basic bankruptcy of American society that's happened. It's funny, being a Canadian, I've always grown up, America to me was always like a big brother, kind of, you know, and you kind of feel when you're young, if you have a big brother, then no bullies, you know, if anyone tries to bully you, your big brother will protect you. So we, in Canada, we hardly had any military in Canada, very small military, and we've never had nuclear weapons and so on. But in a way, we were kind of part the neighbor and friend of the United States of America. So we always kind of thought we had protection by that. And we have. I forget what my point is going to be. So in a way, but I guess I'm saying in a way, as a Canadian, I always grew up like buying into that great fantasy of the American dream and, you know, United States, you know, had justice in its courts and the police generally, you might find occasionally corrupt police, but not as a massive systemic problem. Corruption throughout the whole court system, throughout all your agencies. The whole system is like so unbelievably corrupted. There is no justice. United States people, you're just being ripped off by these corporate elites, and they just charge it all up to your tax bill. So you're, as a nation, what, $4 trillion in debt? Some huge, huge amount. It'll be never paid off. We're all going to end up becoming slaves and prisoners, and they'll have little chips in our body so we can get our $5 worth of gas. We face huge problems throughout the planet, and we need a revolution, and that begins with people waking up to the horror of what is happening. Life can't go on as usual. Once you begin to wake up, you can't let it go because you realize, well, they're mass murderers trying to murder people. They're doing this around the world now. Not only in Iraq. You think all the forces, the Canadian-American forces over in Iran protecting America from terrorists, okay? Meanwhile, the real terrorists are spraying people in the United States with biowarfare weapons from above. You're being sprayed all the time. I watched on YouTube, I watch these videos of the chemtrails in Las Vegas. Like dozens of them. Dozens of them. They spread biological weapons. They can use these methods for biological weapons. They're spreading heavy metals, carcinogenic matter. They're spraying people. Your children, your farmland, your water. One fellow on Coast to Coast says he flies over America and is like just everywhere. The skies aren't the same. They have so many pollutants in them. And meanwhile, they want to introduce a global credit, tax carbon credit, so everybody can be taxed more. That's just the solution, because they want to protect the Earth from our global warming, okay? And now we just, this week, had a petition signed by 23,000 scientists disputing the global warm claims. You see, global warming, as it's been presented to us, is a complete fraud. They're not really caring for the environment. They just want to have another way of taxing and enslaving people. That's what it's about. It's part of their New World Order agenda. The problem with in trying to enlighten most people about these events and what our situation is that people's minds are like sieves. So the more information and knowledge you put in, it just, all the time, it leaks out. It's not retained, and then you don't grasp the whole of it. But then what's happening now is that people are beginning to grasp the whole, the horror of the situation of contemporary humankind. So much has been hidden from us. See, I see the thing more and more as a whole systematic, intentional effort. Through the foundations, the educational system, we've been lied to so much about ourselves, the world, everything. It's like Gurdjieff and Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. He says one of the purposes of his book is to, quote, destroy without mercy all the rubbish accumulated through centuries of human mentation. And I think if we could do that, we have been accumulated all this rubbish in our false consciousness system. We believe the government looks after us, that they protect us, that we spread democracy, that the government looks after us, what's in our air and our water and our food. We have this complete sense, we believe there's justice in America. What kind of justice is there in America or internationally? Look at the UN. What kind of organization is the UN? The people in the UN know 9/11 was an inside job. They know that. How could they not know that? Are they complete idiots? They're either incompetent or they're part of it, or they're silenced into not speaking. How can the UN be this force to kind of bring about world unity when it's obviously a corrupted fascist organization? Very serious times we're in. Okay, that's my rant. Jim, you have different views on things I know than myself often. Maybe you want to kind of respond to any things I...
Well, I mean, I think a lot of what you say is, there's a lot to it. I think a lot of it's just your opinion. I mean, I don't think you know. I think it's important to sort of bring up what Uspensky said, is that the most important thing to know is what you do know and what you do not know. I mean, there's lots of interpretations of these things that you have that, I mean, I just don't see them, and I don't think you know these things. I think you think them, but, you know, and I think it's important to remember that. I mean, that's kind of part of the whole false consciousness system with everybody. I mean, when Gurdjieff talks about a false consciousness system, too, I mean, he's talking about it not just in terms of the big picture consciousness, but in terms of, like, our understanding of ourselves as human beings and our psychological illusions that he says that we live under. And the most important one is that we think that we're conscious and that we possess the capacity to do and that we're unified beings. And he says these are psychological illusions imposed by the state of waking sleep in which we live and the mechanicalness that characterizes our normal waking state of consciousness. And formatory apparatus is really the mechanical part of the intellectual center, and it really has its place. I mean, you don't need to deliberate as to what the square of a circle is or what the capital city of Venezuela is, or, you know, there's a lot of information that needs to be incorporated in the formatory center. You know, you need to learn things and remember them. But the problem is that, you know, Thomas Edison said something to the effect that most people don't think, most people can't think, and the last thing in the world that most people want to do is think. And what he meant was, what he was referring to, I think, is the idea that people think with, deliberate, they think with an open mind, and they really consider things, rather than simply parroting, according to the formatory center's operation, the things that they've been inculcated in them, that they've been conditioned to believe by the education system and by their parents and by their friends and by their, you know, the schools and the churches and the government and nowadays by the media. So, you know, if you ask anybody what they think about the existence of the Sasquatch or God or whatever, you know, it's very rare that people will say, well, I don't know. You know, people can't even admit to themselves that they don't know. It's like there's a great line in there's a Woody Allen film where he thinks he's dying and he starts to turn to all these different religions and he's looking for spiritual answers. And I think it's Hannah and her sisters, and he goes to see his parents, who are this elderly Jewish couple, and he's talking to them about the big spiritual questions and about the meaning of existence and what happens after we die and everything. And he says to his parents, you know, you must have thought about these things. Like, you know, why are there Nazis? And his father says, you know, how the hell do I know why there are Nazis? I don't even know how the can opener works. And I mean, in a sense, that's kind of all of us. Eh? It's like, I mean, people have big ideas about what they understand about everything, but how many people actually really know how the can opener works? I mean, we're surrounded by mysteries and things we don't really understand. So that doesn't mean that we should. Actually, it means that we should be more inquisitive. We should question all authority. We should open our minds to all ideas, and we should really examine things and try to think about what we know and what we don't know, because so much of what we think we know is colored by our own personal histories and our conditioning and our exposure to certain things. And really, you know, the best thing about, I would say, about studying an esoteric teaching or the mystical tradition is that you really see through things. It's like taking LSD, you know, you see through the game structure involved in everything. You see how you are conditioned and how very little you really do know, and how very little of what you think you know and that you think is important really is important. Like, you just see the kind of, you know, the illusory quality of so much of what occurs in life and what's passed off as being important and you know, necessary for to lead a mature, responsible adult existence. And you realize, well, really, most of it's just BS that you've been taught. You know, if you lived in another country, you'd be taught a whole variety of other BS, you know, which really doesn't have anything to do with living, but it's presented as such. You know, and I mean, and so much of what happens, I don't think it's as conscious as you do. I think people are motivated by the three lower chakras, by the desire for power, sex, and money, and that it makes them do all sorts of unconscionable and terrible things. You know, the result of it is that we're in this fine mess that we're in. And, you know, I mean, everything you said about the lies and the deceit, I mean, in terms of presenting that, you know, the Western powers are democracies, I think they're demonocracies. I think they're
demonocracies.
Yeah, they're
psychopathocracies and demonocracies.
Psychopathocracy is great. I think they're governed by demons, and I think that the demons who govern point to other demons to legitimize their demonology. So it's like,
yeah, I mean, there's different elements in here and different demon forces.
Oh, yeah, there's.
You know, they say Satan has a hierarchy of servants.
Yeah.
So I believe that there is such a hierarchy. Like there are like an inner group of people who do have plotted and schemed these things. And then they've infiltrated from above down in a way through other parts of the judiciary and the police services and the military and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
so we differ in how much we see this as, is it just due to the collective efforts of men number one, two, and three, people controlled by money, sex, and power, or is it a conscious, intentional process actually schemed by a criminal elite to bring about the world governance?
Yeah, and I think that's a formatory formulation of the question. I don't think it's an either or. I think there are elements of both. I mean, I would say
yeah,
that there,
well, I would agree with that too.
I think that at various levels there are criminal enterprises who very deliberately, I wouldn't say consciously, but very deliberately and with malice aforethought do scheme these awful things and do carry out, you know, horrendous activities and do exploit people. But other things, I think things happen in a lot of different ways. I think people motivated by these other things cause certain things to be set in motion. And I mean, there's a lot of different elements to all this. I mean, in a sense, too, like, I mean, and I don't think, you know, in the next few years, I mean, yeah, something horrible could happen, but something horrible could happen at any moment, really. Ever since we got the bomb, it's been in the, you know, the possibility that the whole world could be, you know, exploded. The entire Earth could blow up, basically.
I remember having that similar feeling back in the mid-'80s. At that time, it was the kind of nuclear weapons around the world.
Yeah. I remember even before that. Like, I remember in 1962 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, I mean, this to me was one of the, I think one of the most profound experiences of my life was that, it was in October 1962. And I remember asking my mother if she thought there was going to be a nuclear war. I was 12, and she said she thought about it because she was trying, deliberating whether to be honest with me. And then she said, yes, I think there is. And she was really scared. I mean, she thought there was going to be a nuclear war. And my mother was not stupid. She was a pretty intelligent person. And I remember coming home from school that day and eating lunch across the street with my neighbor. And we had Campbell's tomato soup and hot dogs. And I was thinking, geez, you know, I didn't even get to order my own lunch. You know, it was like even guys on death row get to order their own lunch. You know, it was just presented to me. And I thought that the world was going to end that afternoon, sometime before the day was over, that there was going to be a nuclear war. And that was kind of, that was part of my consciousness of growing up as to what the world consisted of in terms of these weapons. And I thought at the time, as a 12-year-old, there's something very seriously wrong with human beings, you know, and I think that really predisposed me in some real sense to accept Gurdjieff's idea that the world is governed by people who are sleepwalkers. I mean, to me, that's the most economical and accurate representation of how everything happens. I mean, I see it much more deeply even than I did 30 years ago when I started to study the fourth way. You know, you read Everything Happens and you think, oh yeah, everything happens. And it's a revolutionary idea in a sense that when you're challenged to think that. But I see it in much more deeper levels how everything happens, I think, now. But as I say, I think I was predisposed to accept that because, as Uspensky says, in order to be attracted in some way to the fourth way, you have to have a certain dissatisfaction with the explanations of life that come from the usual sources of authority. And I, you know, I think that described you and I as psychology students and as social scientists, you know, when we were at university, undergraduates and graduate students, is that we thought there was something essential missing in these accounts. And I think it's the essential that's missing is an understanding of consciousness and what it really points to, because it points to a completely different understanding of everything that exists in the world. I mean, the other side of all this too is that while we're focused on all these negative forces and everything, there are also, I think, at the same time, these unseen positive forces that are acting on the earth. I mean, we can't see them, and at times it's hard to kind of even remember that idea, but I think that they're there. You know, I think they're all around us. I think they're in us. Like I think there's a current of energy and intelligence which is trying to serve people who seek to awaken and to evolve, and I think that's the corrective to this downward spiral that we seem to be caught in on the material plane, I don't profess to have any understanding as to what that means, but I think that concept is sort of, I think people forget that, and I don't know that, but I believe it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we don't, as you say, we don't know. I think what we see in life is the triumph thus far of these kind of criminal psychopathic elite. That's what we see in life. And it's hard to know what forces might be there and of what, like, the spiritual hierarchy. Like, just as I would say there's a satanic hierarchy, but then I believe that there are also there's a spiritual hierarchy, and that there are other beings or entities or masters who, through subtle dimensions and so on, also are involved in this equation, and that we can't.
Yeah,
and I think there are other signs, as you say. I mean, I think there's this great awakening happening, and that there's going to be a new American revolution, and as significant as the earlier revolution. Like, people are realizing, oh, America's been hijacked. We've been hijacked. You know, from the development of the Federal Reserve and the structuring of our society, we've been hijacked. We've been sold out.
Yeah, but I've been a lot more political than you have over the last 40 years, and I there's been lots of, I thought, openings and movements towards things, and it never seems to really amount to it.
Exactly,
all that much. I mean,
yeah.
You talk about the 9/11 commission. Well, I'll go back to the Kennedy assassination. The information isn't coming out now. It's been there from day one when Mark Lane and people in the early 60s started writing about Rush to Judgment, As I say, if somebody wants to tell me that Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated John Kennedy, that's fine, they're entitled to believe that, but, that to me is like believing in Santa Claus. Preposterously out of whack with the facts of the case, and when I hear people talk about conspiracy theorists, I just dismiss them. I think they're idiots, because, I mean, anybody who looks at this with an open mind knows that this is not what happened. I mean, it's just so patently obvious that it was much, much more going on. And actually, the more you read about it, the more you study it, you realize that there couldn't have been a bigger collection of whack jobs in any one place than there was in Dallas and in Louisiana and in Florida in the 60s, in the United States. I mean, good Lord, what a bunch of, wild human beings were running around there, and Lee Harvey Oswald is sort of caught up in all this. It probably as a government military agent, and Kennedy had to die. Like, this was part of the plan, And as much as I say, I mean, this is my own feeling of it now, and my own views have evolved over the last 40 years. But I would say that as much as all the scorn that was heaped on Oliver Stone, I think what he says in JFK, I think, is probably closest to the truth, that I think there was some sort of a military intelligence coup, and that Kennedy was assassinated by certain elements, not necessarily by the CIA. CIA is a big organization with a lot of different people in it, many of whom are honest, patriotic, principled people, but there are also a lot of criminals in it too, and a lot of criminals in the American military, as well as a lot of upright and courageous and patriotic people. So it's neither one nor the other, but I think there were definitely elements that had decided that Kennedy had to go, and that he was assassinated for that reason.
It was essentially a military coup. I mean, that's how I would see it. And Kennedy was wanting to rein in what he saw as underlying American society. So
and then you say, the ultimate irony is that, he fires Alan Dulles from the CIA after the Bay of Pigs, and who ends up on the Warren Commission investigating his assassination? Alan Dulles. I mean, you know what? The Fox wasn't wasn't around to investigate what happened in the hen house, you know?
Yeah.
That's so absurd. It's just, you know, it's just, it makes you laugh. Like, I mean, it's like, please, you know, we're supposed to take this seriously. I mean, come on, you know?
Yeah, you see the complicity of so many other additional people when you realize how all the investigations are, they never really objectively look at the data. You know, the witnesses are murdered, and there's tons of truth in anything. You know,
there's tons of objective investigations. They're just usually not done by anybody who's. I mean, really, that's what's interesting about the Kennedy assassination, and also vis-a-vis what's happening with the 9/11 truth movement. Like, there's this huge, you know, scholars for 9/11 truth. I mean, a lot of very respectable people, but. You know, in the Kennedy assassination, it was people like Mark Lane, who was a lawyer in New York, and Mae Russell, who was a housewife, and I can't think of that other woman's name, another housewife. And, you know, these were people who were not professional investigators or journalists, per se, but who started the whole, like, well, wait a minute, you know, I read the Warren Commission, and it doesn't really make sense, you know. I mean, and took a lot of effort because it's very complex. You know, story and was presented immediately for people's consumption instead to, you know, to resolve what happened. And then, of course, very conveniently, Ruby was killed and everything. I mean, I'm blanking on his name, the Canadian diplomat who teaches in the former Canadian diplomat who teaches in the States and has written extensively about this, has a paper on parallels between the Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission, and you know, I mean, it's essentially the same thing over again. Is that you put people in place who channel the story. You start with a predetermined conclusion, and then you gather evidence to support your predetermined conclusion. You know, and that's the commonality between the 9/11 Commission, I would say, and the Warren Commission.
Yeah, I mean, they were both cover-ups, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And sanctioned to, you know, to. Although the only difference was that Lyndon Johnson created the Warren Commission within a couple of weeks, a few days after the Kennedy assassination, and George Bush waited 444 days to create the 9/11 Commission, and only did so because. Relatives of the people who were killed there demanded that he do so. I mean, he fought it tooth and nail, you know.
Which
in and of itself, why didn't that come up when he sought re-election, you know? Like, I mean, you might want to ask him about that, but, you know, instead they were talking about whether or not John Kerry was a flip-flopper, you know? I mean, you know, you're a flip-flopper. I mean, that was what the debate was about, and whether or not, you know, what his record in Vietnam meant. I mean, it's like, you know, please.
Yeah.
The next time anybody has an intelligent conversation about anything in a presidential election will be the first time, you know. It's just like, you just see how it's all conducted on such a incredibly superficial and shallow and essentially meaningless level of debate. Like, you know, I mean, anybody who takes any of it seriously has got, you know, to me, is brain damaged, you know. Like,
yeah.
I haven't got any use for it whatsoever.
Yeah, I think people are waking up more on a broader social influence now, and people are beginning to wake up and kind of realize, like, wow, how much we've been deceived about all of these things. And
yeah, some people, but most people aren't. I mean, but even that, too, is like, you know, I mean, if you look at the polls about how many people think that the official story stinks about 9/11, I mean, in David Ray Griffin's books, you know, he cites those, and very surprising, the numbers in New York City, the number of Americans, the number of Canadians, the percentages are very high, and this is a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yet it doesn't really seem to translate into, look who's running for president, you know, like, I mean, it doesn't really, I mean, what was the last time that Hillary Clinton, Obama, or John McCain ever said anything about 9/11. You know, this is the whole basis for the war on terror. When have they ever said anything about it? They haven't said one word about it. They don't want to talk about it.
No.
You know? I mean, and that's the problem. It's like, people can know things, but in order to translate them into meaningful political action, it's like, what's that T.S. Eliot line? Between the reality and the act falls the shadow, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's a big shadow between people knowing things and it actually being translated into actions.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, sort of changing frame of reference a little bit, just for a previous program, I came across this book last week by Fritjof Capra called The Hidden Connections, and the subtitle is A Science for Sustainable Living.
Oh.
And it's a more recent book by him. I think it's 2003, 2002. And the first part, he's trying to deal with the nature of life and the nature of consciousness. And then the second part, he's talking about this model that he's putting forth. He's trying to suggest that in order to understand the nature of life and consciousness, we have to. He's trying to incorporate complexity theory, essentially non-linear mathematical dynamics and how it relates to our understanding of the arising of life and consciousness. And then the second part, he has it in terms of the part two is subtitled The Challenges of the 21st Century, and it's in he refers to the networks of global capitalism and life and leadership and organizations and biotechnology at the turning point. And he's talking about this in sort of in a societal context, in the context of the you know global economy and all this stuff, and also like especially biotechnology. But so I stumbled across this book, and I didn't even know it existed. And Capra, for those who don't know, is an Austrian physicist who published the Tao of Physics in, I think, 1975 or 74, in which he put forth the thesis that essentially the worldview that is presented in modern physics about the dynamic nature of physical reality is in some ways very similar to that which is characteristic of the main teachings of Eastern religions, and he explores these ideas. And it was a very influential book. And then he had a book, The Turning Point, a few years later, in which he talked about the emergence of a new paradigm in Western science, which was going to do with the old mechanical Cartesian dualistic Newtonian mechanical picture of the universe, and you know, he's a very interesting guy. He explores a lot of different topics in science from a lot of different perspectives, and he has a very definitely a spiritual perspective. So, you know, I thought, well, this looks interesting. So I sort of jumped ahead. The first part of the book is called Life, Mind, and Society, and the first chapter is the nature of life, and the second chapter is on mind and consciousness. And so I read this chapter to see, well, what does he say? And I guess I was kind of stunned by what he says when he's dealing with mind and consciousness, because he quotes the work of Edelman and a few other modern consciousness researchers. And what struck me about it in terms of he's trying to suggest that he's breaking down the old Cartesian dualism and the mechanical picture of things, but in terms of your work, I mean, this is the head doctrine par excellence, you know, and it's also still essentially a reductionist approach to. He says it isn't, because what he's trying to explain is how in complexity theory and the theory of structures, you have mathematical modeling of how certain material processes can lead to the emergence of higher order complexity through perturbations in the system, and that systems reach a point in which they're disturbed and then they reorganize themselves on a higher level. And Ilya Prigogine, the guy who developed the theory of dissipative structures, which is a specific example of complexity theory, has argued that this explains a variety of biological phenomena too. I think that's what he argues.
Yeah, but as you're saying, like it's not a reductionist. It's still a neo-reductionist viewpoint.
Yeah, and what strikes me about it most, and now I jump back and I was reading today. I didn't really have time to read the entire chapter, but he's talking about the nature of life, and again, see, like what he's talking about is to me, it's all like everything is happening for him on the material plane. Now, to go back to what we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, like everything he's talking about is in terms of the evolutionary current. See, but what's missing is that there's no involutionary current, and there's no sense of scale of consciousness, that consciousness is something which is which exists on a different levels in some sort of a hierarchy, or in David Bohm's work to convey a sense of movement, a holarchy. Like, there's no idea of gradients of higher consciousness descending through different levels or dimensions of reality and informing the material plane. So everything in Capra's model, in both the psychological and on the biological level, everything is evolving out of these lower orders of physical matter. And I was really quite sort of disappointed, to say the least, by his perspective, because I think he's really kind of arguing against what he purports to be trying to develop in terms of understanding things. So in future weeks, like, I'd like to come back to this and talk a little bit more in detail as I like to reread this and can present it in more detail.
I agree. I mean, I see that in Roger Sperry's writing, who in the mid-80s was supposed to be this new cognitive revolution in psychology, and he kind of wanted, we got to get rid of religion and kind of ancient metaphysical ideas, and what we have is, nested hierarchies, and that somehow through these kind of nested hierarchies, we have new phenomena emerge out of matter, but it's all emerging out of matter.
Right.
They don't consider the idea that life might come from within without, that there's the life force emerges from within and is embodied into the material being.
But and that it informs, like that word is really appropriate, eh?
Informs.
It informs, like it provides information or intelligence which, in terms of light, illuminates processes on the material level. And I mean, that's the conundrum that in Capra's book that just isn't discussed at all. And like you say, like, I mean, nested hierarchies, yeah, there are nested hierarchies. I mean, that's the whole notion of the great chain of being, and all ancient esoteric and mystical teachings are based on that, the idea that, there are nested hierarchies of consciousness and dimensions of higher spiritual realities. But that's what's missing from all these, that's what's wrong in my mind with these modern scientific viewpoints, is that they don't recognize that there's anything beyond the material. And yet, if you take all the anomalies and enigmas which surround, I mean, Capra goes on about life, and then he says, but everybody agrees that these material explanations are underlying life, but nobody can really explain it. Well, it's exactly the same with consciousness. It's like everybody agrees that the consciousness emerges out of the brain, but nobody can explain how it happens. Well, I don't agree with it, and you don't agree with it, because we have a different explanation as to how that happens. You know, it's so peculiar how people are so blind to this, and don't sort of want to really take the dramatic step of stepping out of all these Western assumptions that have emerged over the last 300 years in thinking about consciousness and life.
Yeah, I agree. I think we need a whole new understanding and approach to it. And I agree. I don't think Capra arrives at that in the book you've been mentioning. It's the idea is that life comes from above or from within without, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and people don't consider that.
Even though,
and what that would mean in terms of studying, like, the brain and the mind and other phenomena.
Even though, in a sense, like, I mean, in the real sense, above and within and without, all that, those terms are sort of, they're not really accurate in a sense, but, I mean, they're representations for us to understand things that really exist in a completely different spatial-temporal coordinate or system or something. I'm not really
well,
sure.
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, it's exactly true, because what we're saying is that there are hyperspace dimensions.
Yeah.
And that phenomena occurring in higher dimensions of space-time give rise to the phenomena we think are purely material. But there's this whole higher dimensional inner dynamic which underlies what is made manifest.
Yeah.
It's like in Kabbalistic tree of life and the symbol of the ladder of Jacob. And you string four trees of life together. And there are said to be four worlds of emanation, creation, formation, and the world made. And it's like modern science simply takes the world made and wonders how the world made is made up of only external influences. It doesn't realize that really underlying the world made is these higher dimensional worlds.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like sometimes you take the enigma of the heartbeat. How in science it's a complete enigma how these cells of the heart have this inherent capacity to generate the basic life impulse within the heart. And everyone looks for an external material cause as to what could cause these cells to function in that way. And people don't consider, well, maybe there's a higher dimensional physics which manifests into that generation of the heartbeat. So they only look for external causes instead of internal causes, but within higher dimensional space. I mean, reality, according to kind of mystical teachings, is so contrary and so completely different than what we ordinarily imagine.
And our conceptualization of, and this is something that isn't recognized by scientists, is our conceptualization of the nature of these processes is, to a certain extent, is determined by the fact that we live in a lower state of consciousness. I mean, we have people who are intellectually more adept than others, but they still exist at the same level of consciousness, whereas those who have achieved higher states of consciousness describe the nature of reality in strikingly different terms and claim to uncover hidden dimensions which underlie and which inform the manifest material world. And you know, they do this consistently to the point where if you really look at the history of human beings' attempts to understand themselves and the nature of the universe, there's a striking consistency in these representations. Sometimes the language differs, sometimes people focus on different parts, but I would say that effectively the whole mystical and esoteric tradition really has to be understood as a science of consciousness and being, and that their systematic development of methods of developing and transforming human consciousness, that people who follow these methods and who receive instructions and are educated, that is, are taught to bring out that which is within, realize essentially the same types of understandings of the nature of these hidden dimensions. And as I say, this to me is like this huge body of evidence which, in trying to understand the nature of ourselves and the nature of the reality of the universe, like the whole of thrust of modern thought just doesn't want to deal with this staggeringly complex and elegant and erudite and empirical body of evidence and theoretical explanations which is there for anybody who takes the trouble to really, you know, to really investigate. It's really quite bizarre in a way. Like,
yeah, people haven't grasped it. Yeah,
and in science, like I say, everybody assumes that consciousness emerges out of the cerebral cortex or some part of the brain and the head, even though nobody's got a clue as to how this happens. And like Stanislav Grof says, it's the fundamental epistemological assumption of Western thought is that consciousness is produced in the brain. And this is from Capra's book where he's talking about prebiotic evolution, that is, the evolution of inanimate matter that it must have begun sometime before the emergence of living cells. And he says that this view is widely accepted among scientists today. So what he's saying is that before there was in the history of the evolution of the universe, that there was this inanimate matter which was lifeless, but this is prebiotic, but then that there was this transformation and that cells began to have some sort of vitality or life. And then he says, although the idea of prebiotic evolution is now widely accepted, there is a consensus among scientists, there's no consensus, pardon me, amongst scientists about the details of this process. In other words, everybody assumes that something happened, but nobody has the first clue as to how to explain it. So again, you're back to square one. Nobody can explain life, and nobody can explain consciousness. Other than that, they've got everything covered, you know. I mean, the most basic phenomena, life and consciousness, and neither one of them is explicable in terms of modern science. And yet modern science claims, oh, you know, we're on the verge of uncovering all these great secrets to how everything works. It's really quite extraordinary.
And it's also so interesting that they don't even acknowledge that there's an alternative perspective.
Yeah,
like they think they're saying the only possible kind of conclusion is that like matter gives birth to life. They don't consider even that there is an alternative viewpoint that life might emerge within, without, and that there are these subtle, complex, hard dimensions underlying the phenomena of life, and like they don't even consider that perspective.
This is what I found so disturbing, sort of, about this book by Capra, is that, I mean, because it actually gets much worse, because in the chapter on consciousness, he talks about cognition rather than consciousness. I mean, he completely sort of buys into the idea that consciousness is cognition, and even like non-human cognition. Like, it's almost like you could, wherever he says cognition, what he really means to say is consciousness. You know, he's got it all backwards in my understanding from what I read the first time. But Capra's aware of, you know, I mean, you know, he practiced Tai Chi, and he's aware of the Eastern religious traditions, and he's aware of the fundamental ideas, and he's very, you know, erudite guy. He's got to have read, you know, about anomalous, well, he's described himself an anomalous state of consciousness and in the Tao of Physics, you know, and I mean, there's no question that he's aware of it, and yet when it comes to trying to develop this revolutionary model, this model that's going to overcome the Newtonian mechanical worldview and the Cartesian dualism, I mean, it's kind of hopefully, and reductionism, it's kind of made, to me, he's stuck in this assumptive framework, which really doesn't answer, is incapable of answering these questions about what is life and what is consciousness. So those are the first two chapters of his book, and I think he's completely missed the boat in terms of, because he's stuck in this very limited worldview, and doesn't even sort of acknowledge that there's this, as you say, this whole alternative explanation of things. And that's what really, I guess, it's so peculiar that this huge body of literature could exist. I mean, you don't have to go and sit in a monastery and study with a master to learn about this. There's a tremendous library of materials which will steer you. Like, it'll be useful to go and sit in a monastery with a master to learn more about this directly. But these ideas exist, and, you know, there's people like you out there writing books and trying to create a dialogue as to how this relates to modern science and modern psychology and modern thought, and yet it just doesn't seem to penetrate people's consciousness and their thinking about things. People are much, I would say, like, again, this is sort of the formatory apparatus. People are much more willing to sort of repeat what they've been conditioned to believe and not really try to think outside of the box, as I've said before, like on previous programs, the irony is that anybody who reads, I'm not a physicist, I'm the farthest thing from a physicist, but I read books on physics, and I know that I'm reading the descriptions of things that are really worked out in terms of mathematics, but if you read the physicists from the 20th century, all the great ones, and you read their speculations on the philosophical implications of what 20th century physics uncovered, they all agree that, really, that physics reaches a certain limit, and as Eddington says, you know, it's a shadow world of substances which they can describe mathematically, but there has to be something beyond that. And this isn't some sort of second-rate guy. This is like a great physicist, and they all say it, you know, that there's more to this. Okay, and Eddington specifically says, you know, we have to turn to mysticism for these answers because science can't provide it. And yet, you know, 75 years later, after Eddington said this, and Heisenberg and Sir James Jeans and all these guys pretty much put forth that there's a major problem here, still, you know, people want to try to explain everything in terms of physical matter and the material plane, and you know there's so much more that it's as I say, it baffles me that people are not more receptive to these ideas. It doesn't mean that they're true, you know. I mean, I think
but at least to consider
that,
it,
but at least it's a way to try to think about it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, and there, you know, there's my kind of model of consciousness, and in it, what I'm suggesting, in a way, is that a human being has something which might be described as like a mini black hole within the heart, that there's an actual physical mini black hole, which is like a vacated space.
Mm-hmm.
Within the plenum, within the kind of infinite energy of that's within life. And there's a vacated space, and there's a higher dimensional physics that emerges from this zero point center, and that this is associated with the physical heart. So that there's actually a life center, and that life and consciousness come into a human being through this higher dimensional physics of the heart. Okay, so it's an actual model that is saying, well, the cause is consciousness doesn't arise from matter. Instead, consciousness, in a way, emerges from within, without, out of this higher dimensional space. So it's a model. It doesn't mean, as you say, it doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It's an alternative way of viewing and interpreting evidences. And it's a model, and that's what the scientists within the mainstream don't even seem to grasp, that there is an alternative, higher dimensional model that we need to be exploring. And there's all kinds of evidences for this, because there is all kinds of evidences for ghosts, ESP, out-of-body experiences, near-death review, memory recurring and flashing before someone's eyes, entering into realms of light, all kinds of paranormal phenomena, which are providing all of these kinds of empirical evidences that there's something more beyond the usual material understanding. And that's why I say the evidences are overwhelming. So we know the materialist perspective is wrong.
Well,
we know that.
Especially when you have the esoteric tradition, where people have consciously and deliberately adopted methodologies in attempt to develop higher states of consciousness and transform the level of consciousness and being, and then in doing so, they claim that there are subtle being bodies, and that it's possible to be conscious in these higher being bodies, and that really we have to understand that these higher being bodies actually inform the lower being bodies, and that they actually physically penetrate the physical body. I mean, there's a whole elegant explanation as to what's going on here, and really, that's what I say. That's what's so peculiar about what Capra's saying, because he's stuck in trying to account for everything from the ground up, you know. See, all these things that he's describing and that people are explaining in terms of he's saying it's a systems approach. Well, I'd say, yeah, okay, there's a systems approach to explaining evolution, and I think that complexity theory is obviously accurate, that there are processes where physical and material processes evolved to the point where there are sudden quantum jumps and there's higher levels of organization. But, you know, at the same time, I think that it's indubitable to me that there's this involutionary process which is descending and which is informing and providing consciousness, light, and information, which is interacting with the evolutionary process, so that it's not just one, it's these two processes, and that human beings are stand between these two currents, as Gurdjieff says, and you know, you have the possibility of overcoming the inertia, which is really leading to entropy in a human being, and actually going against nature and going against God, as he says, and developing these higher levels of consciousness and being. It's like you could enter the evolutionary current on the individual level, but it requires effort and it requires training, and that's why people don't see it, you know. I mean, at the same time, he says that something to the effect that there's an unconditioned source of energy which aids people that they can tap into in terms of developing these higher states of consciousness and being. And it's at the very least, it's a more complex perspective, and it really. To me, like when I read like your work and you're explaining things in terms of the heart doctrine and in terms of the zero point teaching, it resolves so many paradoxes in terms of the things that psychological phenomena. It's a more comprehensive model because it provides explanations to so many things that stand outside the normal psychology, Western psychology, doesn't really have an explanation for. But at the same time, it addresses things like the EPR paradox and the phenomenon of non-locality and the whole inclusion of the holographic paradigm as a way of suggesting how this might operate, at least on the surface. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously probably more complex than you're suggesting or we understand, but in terms of outlining and providing the framework, I think Blavatsky provided it, and people have been providing it for thousands of years, like different elements of it. And
I guess that's what my work in a way has tried. I think it, that's part of the unique contribution of my work, is that I've pulled out the gems from my study of esoteric teachings, particularly the heart to doctrine and the zero point teaching and the general notion of higher dimensional space and things, how things are created within without, like a model of higher dimensional existence. So those three notions I've taken from the esoteric traditions and then show how those can be related to the issues of science and the enigmas of psychical phenomena and so on. So I've developed this alternate model of human existence, kind of fleshed it out, taking the esoteric materials and then trying to explain that in terms of the theories and paradoxes of science. I just want to return to, you'll remember this quote, because I remember reading this 25 years ago or so, and I think it highlights some of the things we've been talking about. And it's Swami Prabhupada who had a discussion with a physicist, Benford. And Swami Prabhupada, it's from a different book of his, but it's from his book called Easy Journey to Other Planets. And this is what Prabhupada wrote. He said, even if a materialist wants to enjoy developed material faculties, he can transfer himself to planets where he can experience material pleasures much more advanced than those available on the planet Earth. One can transfer himself to other planets in the material sky by utilizing yogic powers. The playful spaceships of the astronauts are but childish entertainments and are of no use for this purpose. In the higher planets of the material world, the yogis can enjoy more comfortable and more pleasant lives for hundreds of thousands of years. But life in those higher planets is not eternal. The gross materialists reside on this seventh-class planet, Earth. And it's a difficult quote, but what struck me at the time is like, wow, this character, Swami Prabhupada, is actually claiming that people, yogis, can develop psychical powers and transfer themselves to planets of the material sky or even to planets of the spiritual sky. And I remember thinking at the time, like, wow, we spend like billions and billions of dollars and we blast off a little capsule, supposedly to land on the moon, which I now believe was a whole hoax anyway. But we think that's so advanced, is this kind of material science, if we could actually get to the moon. But then Swami Prabhupada was saying, well, like that's nothing compared to the powers of an advanced yogi. I mean, imagine being able to transfer ourselves to planets of the material or spiritual sky. Like, this is a whole higher kind of dimensional understanding of what we are and what we could be. And I remember thinking at the time, what are the chances I could ever kind of get on a flight and go to the moon or go to the planets? I'm pretty not likely. And yet, does it actually mean that we, through the science of higher consciousness, might be able to transverse and travel within the solar system or even outside of the solar system through the awakening and development of acquiring psychical or spiritual powers and capacities? So, and I remember at the time, like, when I read that from Prabhupada, that was one of the most enigmatic things I had ever read. It struck me as such. And I decided not to dismiss it, because I realized I didn't know that wasn't true.
Yeah.
I couldn't say for sure that that's impossible and that's ridiculous. You know, he's just obviously chanted Hare Krishna too many times.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know that. And it raised this, like, imagine that being true, like how profound that would be. Not only for continued, it proves we'd have possibility for continued life beyond death, which I would say is like one of the most essential and important questions in modern psychology and science, existence beyond death, is like so important to understanding what we are as living beings. But if we could actually travel to these planets and higher dimensional realms, I mean, you know, it's this kind of whole new higher dimensional understanding of what a human being is. And that's within Gurdjieff too, is that we could acquire these kind of unimaginable powers kind of beyond anything we ordinarily conceive. That in a way, like Gurdjieff says, we can... Gurdjieff suggests, you know, most people, when we die, our souls feed the moon.
Yeah.
I think we might have a caller here.
Yeah, hi.
Okay, hold on. I'll just finish my sentence and we'll switch over. So the idea is that the soul could feed the moon upon death, which is what Gurdjieff explains. But he says also, though, a person can acquire his higher being bodies and he can ensure himself, he can attain immortality within the limits of the solar system. So this being would acquire his higher being bodies and have this kind of multi-dimensional existence within the life of the solar system. So what actually suggesting is these really awesome possibilities for human life. Okay, I'll turn over. Would the caller like to just introduce yourself, your first name, and where you're from?
Yeah, hi, guys. It's Phil in Montreal. How are you
doing?
Oh,
hi, Phil.
Hi, Phil.
Welcome. I never got to 0 points. I intended to begin at that today and didn't, but...
That's all right. Good conversation. Good conversation today. Jim, you're talking about Fritjof Capra's books. I happen to have those. I read them some years ago. And some of your points are well taken, but I think you're being a bit harsh with him, because he's just presenting. Remember the turning point. I'm speaking of now the turning point. He's just pointing to the fact that we have to basically take a holistic view. You know, just take a systems approach to understanding the big picture. And he's not suggesting. He's not trying to suggest himself a solution. You know, to all these issues that you're criticizing him for.
I would disagree with you about that, in the sense that in The Turning Point, definitely he's identifying, I think that's a very important book. I like that book a great deal, what he says. But in the book that I was referring to, The Hidden Connections, A Science for Sustainable Living, he talks about what he sees as being important in terms of the current research and in terms of systems theory, and I think he really doesn't deliver the goods. I don't think he meets his own criteria. That's what I'm trying to suggest, is that I was quite disappointed when I started reading his comments on consciousness, because I think he's really caught in the wrong model. I think he's endorsing exactly what he says we have to overcome, and I think he's making very specific suggestions that this is the most promising research, and that this is where we're going to have to go in order to understand things. And that and I wouldn't disagree with what he's saying, that this research is important, because I think it is important. What I question is, is that he's meeting the criteria that he suggests have to be met in terms of the systems. See, to me, like a real systems theory would be one which acknowledges that people are more than collections of physical molecules and aggregations of cells and tissues. I think that's what's lacking in his explanation. I think that's what's lacking in most of the commentary about consciousness, is that people don't deal with the higher dimensions of consciousness, and they don't deal with the idea of a multidimensional human being existing in a multidimensional cosmos, and how those things are related, because I think the mystical and esoteric literature provides a very comprehensive and elegant model of how those things are related, but nobody wants to sort of go beyond the material and try to understand things from that perspective. That's what I'm criticizing Capra about. I think The Turning Point is a very, very valuable and important book. I think The Tao of Fishes is a great book, but in this latest book, it's not. I don't even know if it's his latest book, but as I say, I don't think he delivers the goods. I mean, somebody else might have a very different understanding of it, so we can have that debate later. But
I was commenting mainly. I haven't read his latest book, and his position may have changed since when he wrote The Turning Point. But I was referring mainly to The Turning Point, because it did seem to me in that book that he was very definitely criticizing what you're precisely saying, you know, that it's an inadequate to not consider the metaphysical realms and the multidimensional aspects of quantum mechanics and general holism in general, in other words, what he's calling a systems approach. I thought to me he was exactly right, you know, but he's not attempting to answer that question. He's stating that is the question, I felt, in The Turning Point.
Okay, and that's...
But you hit it right on the head, if I could turn away from that now for just a second, to your other work relating to Prigogine's work and nonlinear dynamics. And that's exactly, I believe, as you say, you know, how complexity leads to nested systems, complex systems, you know, talking to each other. The key process for the evolution of strange attractors, for example, the generation of complexity, is that you need to have the output of an iteration becoming the input for the next cycle. And that's what you get when you have nested systems. You have it like in our own biosphere, you have the water cycle, you know, water becomes water vapor, becomes cloud, becomes rain, becomes water, you know, that the formation of offsetting processes is what leads to the dissipated structures. And that's how we, you know, that's how we temporarily win the battle or hold our own against entropy, as you were saying, you know, so you're really very well characterizing this work, but I believe that not stated maybe in Capra's books, that is the key, you know, to how complexity and evolution leads to ever more complex life, and consciousness, of course, is a whole question on its own as how and why that arises from simple complexity. That's a contradiction in terms, but anyway, there you have it.
Simple complexity. If it does arise.
Yeah, and I don't think it does. I mean, that's where I disagree with. That's why I say I think that part of the explanation is very compelling, and I think it's true. But I think it's true only on a limited basis. Like, in terms of somebody who puts forward a more comprehensive systems theory type of explanation, I've read a couple of books by Irvin Laszlo, Science and the Reenchantment of the Cosmos and Science in the Akashic Field. Do you know his work at all, Phil? Are you familiar with him?
No, I don't know that guy, you know.
He's really interesting, because I think he's on to I mean, I would say that his work in some ways is an interesting complement to some of the things Christopher's suggesting, and I think he's somebody who does recognize that we have to go beyond material explanations and is trying to understand these things in terms of consciousness. And I think he provides a lot of very interesting, he's a very erudite guy. I mean, he's quite brilliant, and he incorporates material from a lot of different disciplines. And he is a systems theorist. That's his training and his principal vocation. And I think, as I say, what I found so in this latest book by Capra what I found so disappointing is that I think he really, he doesn't, his holism to me isn't holistic. And his ecological perspective, to me, isn't ecological. It is within the limits of the material plane, but it stops there. And I'll go back to this whole thing that Christopher brought this up a couple of weeks ago, and I think this is so essential, is that he talked about how in Western thought there isn't this recognition of an involutionary current to complement the existence of an evolutionary current. Like everything is talked about in terms of the evolution of from the simple to the complex, and it involves material processes, and that in that sense dissipative structures, you know, provides a mathematical explanation of how these processes occur and how the phenomenon of emergence occurs. I don't doubt that these things happen, but I seriously question as to whether or not that's a comprehensive explanation of life or consciousness, because I don't think it is.
Of course it's not comprehensive, because that's like taking just the TV set without the power grid, without the cable hookup. That's just taking the circuitry and trying to figure out, well, this is not the comprehensive system. You know, this cannot explain alone how you get consciousness and creativity and such. No question. I'm a student of Penrose, okay, and Penrose is a strong believer in the role of consciousness in the big picture understanding of the universe. Okay, so you're dealing with structures and matter and physics, shall we say, and you're dealing with information flow and consciousness and metaphysics, okay, and there's an interplay between those things that we don't understand yet. And that's everybody and his brother, since entanglement was confirmed in 1986, everybody and his brother has been pointing to, you know, the quantum measurement problem and non-locality and metaphysics and zero points and saying, that's the explanation for everything. Well, it is the explanation for everything, including your own work, Chris, but no one has spelled out the exact fine details using physics language yet, and that, you know, that's what's lacking. And you've explained your work to over a million people just on coast to coast alone, and why aren't they getting it, you know? Why doesn't people get the connection? It's because no one has quite put their finger on the... Somewhere in Blavatsky's work, there's a clue, I'm sure, you know, like many other works, Bibles and religious writings included, there are clues all over the place as to that precise step-by-step flow of information and how it should be interpreted and modeled to make it really understood, you know.
I mean,
where we slap our foreheads and say, I get it, you know. That's
one thing is, see, these ideas, they can't simply be grasped by the mind. I mean, they can. Like, you can grasp the idea of the heart center, of the zero point. But you have to, it's like, as you understand these things, you hear it over and over and over again, always understanding it more deeply until the knowledge is kind of incorporated into your being. And it's not simply something you have up in your head as an idea. It's something you have direct, immediate experience of, so you have understanding because you have the kind of knowledge and experience of it. And then you realize more and more, like the heart doctrine, even though I wrote my book 20 years ago and I keep revising it and developing it, every time I lecture on it and rewrite the book, I understand it more and more deeply. So it's like a lifelong process. It's not so, like... just give someone the knowledge of the heart doctrine or the zero point teaching, because it's only something they acquire it in the mind as an idea. And esoteric ideas are not, they're something that needs to be experienced within one's experience as well. They're not simply things that could be known by the mind in the typical state of normal consciousness. We have to kind of, so these ideas, it's like you say, you know, I was on coast to coast, I've been on there twice, and, you know, have a kind of nightly audience of 10 million on the nights that I was on, likely about, you know. But how many people in the consciousness literature are even beginning to mention consciousness? Greg Braden is, and I heard his coast to coast interview, which was very interesting and had many similar points to my own work.
There's definitely a problem of language somewhere where we do need to try to find, as I pointed out 2 weeks ago, we need to try to find a kind of a standardized language for which everyone agrees on all the terminology and the concepts behind them and so on.
Yeah.
And, you know, something you brought up earlier about Swami, what's his name there?
Prabhupada,
speaking about how shamans and people like that can visit planets, you know, anything you can imagine. This is just outer body travel, but very skilled.
Yeah.
Remote viewing and outer body travel, these phenomena are well known and, as far as I'm concerned, completely demonstrated and therefore need to be explained. And a complete explanation of consciousness will explain those paranormal states that you listed earlier, Jim, and they are valid data as much as black holes, which need to be explained. And only when all those things have been explained will we say, fine, we've got the big picture. When nothing, you know, escapes that dragnet, then we have the big picture. But until then, something's missing.
Or it might resolve things at one level and then kind of open us up into another realm of questions and such.
Because any correct idea should act as a beacon to illuminate others, you know, and these questions should fall like dominoes once we have the right idea. And there's a lot of right ideas in your work, but I guess since it came as a surprise to you, you know, about visiting planets by sheer will, that, you know, your model isn't fully complete yet because it's always under ongoing development. I hear you when you say that, you know. So that's everybody's journey. That's everybody's road to enlightenment, and they got to find a reference point and begin, you know, or continue, or as like that, you know. So there are still questions. And there are answers floating around us, and we've got to put it all together.
Well, I mean, I think to my knowledge, I'm the only one who I know of who I think has a higher dimensional model that could potentially explain these phenomena. Like, of course, my work's not complete, because for anything to be comprehensive, it would be a pretty long book. Because, you know, I try to get at some key elements, but then, you know, the articulation of that and the drawing it out and converting it into the language of physics and you know, that's a whole process that, you know, it's going to involve generations of scholars and people, researchers.
Yeah. I haven't read their books, but, you know, Lynn McTaggart, The Field, Dean Radin, whatever his is called, The Matrix or something.
Entangled Minds.
These people believe they have quantum mechanical explanations of consciousness and you know, that they think they're explaining basically the same body of facts that you believe you're explaining.
Yeah,
and
but my work's way beyond theirs. They don't, is way beyond theirs in terms of...
Yeah, I'm not in a position to say. But
yeah,
I'm just
saying that. I mean, I've read Lynn McTaggart's The Field and very good, valuable material on zero-point fields, but she doesn't have the concept of a human being as having a zero-point center.
Well, I could speak, I think, you know, because I'm a little bit more objective. I mean, I think Chris is pretty objective about this, but you know, we've been friends for 40 years, so I obviously have a vested interest in this, and I've worked with Chris on his books for many years, but... I mean, you know, I've read Lynn McTaggart, and I've read Dean Radin, and I've read Ken Wilber. I mean, Ken Wilber is a very good example, too, because Ken Wilber is an esoteric scholar and a philosopher and someone who certainly understands probably more scholarly about these things than Chris or I. And yet, what I see in Wilber's work is he falls into, I think, some of the same traps like the head doctrine in his work. I don't know of anybody's work, and this doesn't make it correct, but to me, I think Chris is way beyond these other people in terms of, I think his work is much more comprehensive and is much more, integrates, I think it's a better integration and provides a better basis for a dialogue between science and the esoteric and mystical tradition and the religious tradition, too, because that's the other part of all this, is that religious traditions have to awaken to these things too. It's not just science that if we're going to expand human knowledge reach a greater understanding of ourselves, the religious traditions have to adapt to these scientific discoveries, and they have to adapt to the existence of the esoteric tradition too, I would suggest.
I think that's really interesting. It reminds me, like,
in Hinduism, in the Gita, and it says, Lord Krishna says, I am the Self, seated in the hearts of all beings. Okay. So, but if you ask most Hindus about the kind of origin of consciousness and the self, none of them really realize what their own sacred books were saying about that.
Oh, I know. I've seen that phenomenon in many ways. I totally agree.
Yeah, in all different religions. Yeah.
They are lost in their own metaphor set, you know, and it's only by... My authority in all such writings is Joseph Campbell, okay? I like to read Joseph Campbell because he's sort of taking a secular approach, an analytic approach to all these different metaphors, and I learned a lot from Joseph Campbell's work. But speaking of zero-point centers, then, have you read the work? I think his name is Sureda. Is that a book called The Singularity, I think, or Singularity?
No, I haven't. I heard him on Coast to Coast, but I haven't read his book. No, I'd like to.
I haven't read his work either, you know, but I believe that
his model of the singularity more is that this is something that we're approaching to as like the world or evolution of the planet as a whole, that we're kind of coming to the singularity, which is like the between the alpha and the omega, like the original starting point, the original singularity, or the ending singularity. Like Braden does, like when he talks of awakening to zero point, he's dealing with like the evolution of our whole society and system to a final like zero point or singularity condition. But
so we're back to Capra's turning point, basically.
Well, I'm not sure about I haven't read that book, so I can't comment on that.
One thing
I would say that like when I heard Sarada on Coast to Coast, he doesn't, again, I would say he doesn't have the concept of a human being as having a singularity zero-point center associated with the higher dimensions of the heart. See, I'm very specific in what I'm saying about the nature of existence has to do with the mystery of the higher dimensional physics of the human heart.
Right.
So when I heard Sarada, like, he still had the kind of, like, looking for the singularity out in the universe somewhere. Whereas I would say, no, it's within your own heart. And also people who think about the singularity, they think there's the first singularity of creation, and then they think there's the final singularity at the end, but they don't think the singularity condition exists the whole time in between.
Right.
Like they think there's the alpha and the omega, but I would say the singularity is the foundation of existence all the way from the alpha point to the omega point.
Right.
So there's certain things in my work I've never seen anyone. I mean, no one in the scientific community addresses my work, really. I've heard of.
Well, I think it's
hard to say.
at the very least, I think one of the most important things in your work, Chris, is that, and this is something that, based on my own reading of esoteric literature, I've verified to a certain extent, is that your whole challenge to the head doctrine is incredibly important. And, I mean, that comes for me in part out of Gurdjieff's ideas about us being three-brained or seven-brained beings, depending on how you look at it, and the idea that we have distinct centers of intelligence that inform and guide our different functions. And I think that's one of the assumptions that just is so ingrained in people thinking about the nature of consciousness and what it means to be human. And I mean, what it means, what the I experience consists of is that, you know, years ago, Theodore Roszak wrote a great book called Where the Wasteland Ends, and he talks about that, how consciousness is under the hat and challenges this idea that people are, modern thinkers are essentially a bunch of head cases who think about consciousness and end up thinking that it's in the head, and he doesn't say it quite as clearly as you do, Chris, but he definitely is onto it, and I think at the very least that's as a heuristic in terms of trying to think about consciousness in a very different way, that's a fundamental challenge to the whole thrust of modern thought. Like, I'm absolutely convinced that consciousness is not produced in the head brain. I think that's completely wrong. And
I notice we're coming right down to time here, so I'm going to need to kind of take control a little bit, just sum up, and we're just a minute. Thanks for calling in, Phil.
Okay,
I'm sorry we don't have time to continue on.
Have a good couple of weeks.
I hope to get to 0 points next week, and I really wanted to explore quantum gravity a little bit in the holographic physics. So hopefully, you might call in again next week. I'll begin with the zero point material at the first.
right.
Okay, thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
Bye.
Okay, I'll give out my website, www.zeropoint.ca. And I've just revised my most important book, The Heart Doctrine, a new version of that. And I'm going to be putting the new image and cover up there within the next day or so. I would encourage people. I think that's the most important book. Thanks, James Moffitt, for contributing today. Jim, we'll be back in 2 weeks. I hope not too many terrible things go on. So we must be close to the end of our hour. Or one last comment on the head doctrine. In The Voice of the Silence by Blavatsky, she describes the I doctrine as being for the many. And the I doctrine is like the doctrine of the elites, of the third eye, whereas Blavatsky states the heart doctrine is for the elect. So Blavatsky says, instead, in terms of the study of occultism, the heart doctrine is more advanced than the eye doctrine of the pseudo-Illuminati. Okay, so try to awaken the experience of self within your heart and have courage to face these times ahead. Thank you all. Thank you, BBS Radio.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.